From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. After a Supreme Court term marked by a series of close and momentous decisions, Anthony Kennedy, the justice some have called the most powerful man in the country, will step down. His departure gives President Trump a chance to build and consolidate a conservative majority on the high court.
We will begin our search for a new justice of the United States Supreme Court that will begin immediately.
From Bush v. Gore to gay marriage and abortion rights to the president's travel ban, Kennedy often provided the critical swing vote that interpreted the Constitution and shaped the law of the land. This hour on Point, Justice Kennedy steps down in the coming battle to reshape the court. You can join us on air or online. How did Kennedy leave his mark on the Supreme Court? In your view, what do you want the next Supreme Court justice to be? Who do you want him to be or her to be? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Toronto is Dahlia Lithwick, courts and law reporter for Slate and host of the Amicus podcast. You can find a link to her latest story, Why Anthony Kennedy Gave Up, at our website, onpointradio.org. Dahlia, welcome back to On Point. Always good to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us today from Washington is Josh Gerstein. He's the senior White House reporter for Politico. He also covers the Supreme Court. You can find links to his recent story, Anthony Kennedy Retiring, Giving Trump Opening to Reshape the Supreme Court, at our website, onpointradio.org. Josh, good to have you as well. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, Anthony. Happy to be here.
So let's start with what Kennedy's departure means here. Over three decades, he earned a reputation as a critical swing vote. Dahlia, I'll start with you. Talk about the stamp that Anthony Kennedy will leave on the Supreme Court.
Well, I think it's fair to say that after Sandra Day O'Connor left the court, he became the definitive swing vote. He was the one who would, in a court that was largely 4-4 conservatives, liberals, although he was very conservative, he would occasionally swing vote with the liberal bloc. And that meant that in some of the hot button issues of our time, he was the fifth vote in one way or another. So he was the decider when it came to, say, marriage equality in the Obergefell case. He was the decider in upholding the core themes of Roe v. Wade and later Casey, that there was a right to abortion protected by the Constitution. He was the decider that there would be continued affirmative action in higher education. He was also the deciding fifth vote in Heller, that there was a Second Amendment right to bear arms. He was the decider to strike down core parts of the Voting Rights Act in the Shelby County case. He was the decider in Citizens United. So I think it's fair to say that to the extent that there was a center at the U.S. Supreme Court for the last couple of years, he has definitively been that center.
He was the center. Yeah, but yet, Dahlia, you wrote very recently about his recent decisions, and you point out that there have been 13 5-4 decisions so far this term that have pitted the conservative justices against the liberals. Kennedy went with the conservatives all 13 times.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that he will have ended his career, certainly, ended this term, having voted very, very consistently with the four conservatives. And I think that to the extent that progressives were hoping that his vote was in play, say, for the travel ban, say, for Masterpiece Cake Shop, the cake baker case where he denied service to a same-sex couple, I think folks thought maybe he was in play on some of the big, big hot-ticket issues that ended the term. It was very clear that by the end of yesterday, he was not in play, that he ends his career in some sense as he began it as a rock-rib Republican who voted with the court's conservative wing.
So, Josh, I'd love to come with you with the same question. I think Dahlia summed it up pretty well, but what would you add to the stamp that Anthony Kennedy leaves on the Supreme Court?
Well, I mean, I would say I agree with Dahlia's piece that Kennedy was a very conservative justice. Some of what we're seeing here is the way the court has shifted to the right over time, and that we have a much more conservative court than we used to. And so some people that maybe seemed extremely conservative may seem less so at different times, depending on who their colleagues are. But I mean, I would not underestimate the significance of some of the rulings that Kennedy ushered into law by providing that fifth vote. I mean, these are pretty big asterisks. Abortion and gay rights and same-sex marriage are pretty dramatic impacts of the court on American society. Kennedy also, while supporting the death penalty in general terms, was at the helm of a number of 5-4 decisions, ratcheting it back for minors, ratcheting it back for people who had mental disabilities. So obviously, if you were a 17-year-old facing a death penalty case, you would have felt that Kennedy's vote was very, very critical. But there's no question in a bunch of other areas, Citizens United, maybe one of the most significant cases of the last couple decades, he stood with the conservatives and unleashed a different kind of change in American society.
Mm. Well, I want to talk about a bunch of these cases as well as the cases and his opinions in the current term. But let's talk about what is perhaps his greatest legacy. He authored a number of decisions that advanced gay rights, including overturning the Defense of Marriage Act. And he wrote the majority opinion in the landmark 2015 case that gave same-sex couples the right to marry. Here he is reading from that majority opinion.
No union is more profound than marriage, for it embodies the highest ideals of love, fidelity, devotion, sacrifice, and family. In forming a marital union, two people become something greater than they once were, and would misunderstand petitioners to say that they disrespect or diminish the idea of marriage in these cases. They're pleased that they do respect it. They respect it so deeply they seek to find its fulfillment for themselves. They ask for equal dignity in the eyes of the law, and the Constitution grants them that right.
Justice Anthony Kennedy reading from the majority opinion in the landmark 2015 case that gave same-sex couples the right to marry. Dahlia, assuming that President Trump will pick someone who's more conservative than Justice Kennedy, will a Trump-appointed justice imperil that progress? I mean, let's talk first about gay marriage.
Yeah, I'm so glad you played that clip, Anthony, only because it had Justice Kennedy saying that word that is his watchword, dignity. And that really was, I think, a hallmark of so many of the places, you know, where Josh just talked about where Kennedy would defect and vote with the liberal wing. Often it was because he was very solicitous of ideas about dignity. And one of the things that I think became very difficult for him was that dignity seems to have sort of disintegrated in the American discourse. As to the question, I really do think that in some ways Obergefell and other gay rights have been under attack already because we've seen religious dissenters immediately responding to that decision, by the way, saying that we cannot provide service. We've had refusal to hand over marriage licenses this year, a massive case that the court just punted on about a cake baker who declined to make a cake for same-sex couples. So in a sense, Obergefell was already eating itself up from the inside because religious dissenters were really, I think, standing against the core holding there. I don't think there's much doubt that whoever Donald Trump replaces Anthony Kennedy with will be less solicitous of those rights, will be more apt to side with religious dissenters. And in some ways, while it's hard to say, I don't know that it's the litmus test. I suspect Roe v. Wade is the litmus test for whoever replaces him. But I think it's in the constellation of things that whoever replaces Anthony Kennedy will be much less apt to protect going forward.
Let's go to Nate, who's calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Nate, you're on the air. Good to have you. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you very much, Anthony. I would say looking at who Trump has already put on the court, people have reason to be concerned. If you look at the gerrymandering case recently, he was one of the very small minorities that actually wanted to dismiss the case and basically say that rigging elections is okay. And I'm talking about Gorsuch, where Kennedy at least held the door open. And so Trump campaigned on being against rigged elections and is putting people who would basically support them. And on top of that, the conservative majority is actually being an activist majority when you take a look at the things like the Janus Court case where they overturned standing precedent. So I, as somebody concerned about voting rights, would encourage people to look at a recent Slate magazine article where they said that Gorsuch basically has it out for the Voting Rights Act, because apparently all you have to lose might be your right to vote.
All right, Nate, I appreciate it. Josh Gerstein, among Anthony Kennedy's decisions was a decision that did weaken the Voting Rights Act. But what do you think about what our caller has to say from Milwaukee?
Well, I think this is part of what is so frustrating and was so frustrating about Anthony Kennedy to people on both sides of the aisle, to both or not just the aisle, but conservatives and liberals, right? It was his tendency to dangle or cling to some of these concepts, to sometimes declare them in this clarion call like language, as in the clip that we heard about the same-sex marriage case. But then in the succeeding cases, in the view of many, to be wishy-washy, to wobble in how this was going to be handled. So we had the punt in the Masterpiece cake shop case this year. We also had Kennedy in a similar position on this question of partisan gerrymandering, of politicians basically picking their own voters, a big campaign to go after partisan gerrymandering in its modern version, and many people thinking, oh, Anthony Kennedy is the one who's going to pursue this through and issue a major ruling against partisan gerrymandering. Then at the last minute, the court punts their two cases on that issue, and he departs from the bench. So it's the kind of thing that I think disappoints and confounds people on both sides of the equation.
We're talking about Justice Anthony Kennedy's retirement from the Supreme Court. You can join the conversation. Do you think the Senate should wait until after the midterm elections to vote on a new justice? We'll get into some of the politics of what all of this means when we return from the break. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
July 2016, a woman calls 911.
Hey, we got that emergency.
She sees a man who she says looks mentally ill, and she says she thinks he's got a gun, or at least something shaped like a gun. The police come, they shoot, but they shoot the wrong guy. Hear what happened on the Embedded podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we're talking about Justice Anthony Kennedy, both his decision to retire from the Supreme Court and his legacy on that court. You can join the conversation. What do you make of Kennedy's decision on key rulings this session, like the travel ban, the cake baker, and union cases? Here's Justice Anthony Kennedy being sworn in on February 18th, 1988, by then Chief Justice William Rehnquist.
I, Anthony Kennedy, do solemnly swear
that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
My guests today are Dahlia Lithwick, Slate's courts and law reporter, and Josh Gerstein, who covers the Supreme Court for Politico. Dahlia, I'll start with you on this one. I want to talk about Roe v. Wade and abortion rights. Given that it's a near certainty that President Trump will replace Kennedy with a more reliably conservative justice, and he talked about wanting to overturn Roe v. Wade during the campaign, talk about that. I mean, how would that proceed, an effort to overturn Roe v. Wade? Would it happen suddenly, quickly, over time? What's your view on that?
Well, I think then-candidate Trump, now President Trump, slightly overstates his capacity to force the issue to the court. What he can do is tap somebody that he tells us he has vetted and has promises that this person will overturn Roe. Obviously, there's no way to do that. And I assume none of the 25 folks on his shortlist have actually been interviewed about whether they will do that. But that notwithstanding, I think it's it's fairly clear that those 25 people, which he pledged would pass the litmus test of overturning Roe, one of them will be selected. Democrats do not control the Senate, so presumably one of them will be confirmed. Mitch McConnell tells us that's going to happen in September. So by October, that person is presumably seated. At that point, how it plays out is really a matter of what case comes before the court. We have all sorts of avenues to chip away at Roe, or we can do it directly. Certainly, the various states have been chipping away at Roe. There are, I think, currently 12 states. No, I'm sorry. There are 7 states that have only one abortion clinic left in the state at all because of state efforts to do away with Roe. And so whether it's through one of these trap laws that makes it impossible to operate a facility, whether it's a 6-week, a 10-week, a 12-week, an 18-week ban, a 72-hour waiting period, Arkansas just passed a law that prohibits medication abortions. So one of these efforts to do away with abortion altogether in the states will come before the court, and then the court will decide whether they want to simply say, as they said yesterday in the union's case, with the stroke of a pen, we're overruling decades worth of precedent, or whether they just want to simply do it through the back door of, well, under the Casey standard, this is not an undue burden. Also, this is not an undue burden. Also, a 6-week ban is not an undue burden. There are so many ways to overturn Roe without outright overturning it. I think it's fair to say that if one of these folks is seated, there will be a very, very serious threat to abortion rights in America in the next year or two.
Well, speaking of that, let's go to Janice, who's calling from Somerville, South Carolina. Janice, you're on the air. Go ahead. Thanks for calling.
Okay, so I'm 65 years old. I'm a Catholic practicing. I have family and friends, others. They vote Republican only because of Roe versus Wade. I don't believe that the Republicans will ever overturn Roe versus Wade. It's too good an issue for them. Otherwise, Catholics and Christians will be voting for Democrats who support the environment and social issues because they also care about those issues very much. But it's Roe versus Wade that keeps them voting Republican. They're not going to overturn it. They're just going to chip away at it.
Janice, interesting. Josh Gerstein, some interesting subtle politics there in Janice's call. What do you think?
Well, I don't know if the justices, once they take the court, are looking at these things from a tactical election by election perspective. I think a lot of the folks going to the court, and many of the people on this list that Trump has, which is now, you know, a short list of 25, are ideologues of a certain judicial philosophy that I think would be, at least in theory, more than willing to overturn Roe v. Wade. I think the best possibility for not overturning it stands with Chief Justice John Roberts, who is somewhat reluctant in some cases to make sort of dramatic shifts that could have significant political blowback and ramifications for the court. And so I agree with Dahlia that I think what we're more likely to see is a chipping, a maybe more than chipping, a cracking away at the foundation of Roe versus Wade, and a geographic constriction of where you can obtain an abortion with any degree of confidence in this country over time. But I don't see why the court would necessarily need to have the showdown that would go along with an effort to actually overturn the Roe v. Wade precedent.
Mm. Well, thanks for that call. Let's go to Adele, who's calling from Dearborn, Michigan. Go ahead, Adele. You're on the air, and thanks so much for the call.
Thank you for taking my call, Anthony. I'd like to comment that the Supreme Court's primary role is to uphold private property rights, not rights for people and individuals. And as such, progressive decisions are the exception, not the rule, and they're usually reversals of prior decisions. My last comment is that while Kennedy made some decisions, like in the marriage equality decision, that seemed to be progressive, I think his support for cases such as Citizens United will have much further, larger-reaching consequences than his occasional throwing scraps to progressive causes because of all the dark money that it's allowed to be funneled into political campaigns, especially coming from right-wing groups who are very much against gay rights. Thank you.
Well, Adele, thanks so much for that call. Dahlia, I don't know, I might take issue with the idea of legalizing gay marriage as throwing a scrap to progressive causes. But the idea of the huge significance of the Citizens United decision, which Justice Kennedy provided the fifth vote for and wrote the opinion for, is hugely consequential, right?
Hugely consequential, and I would add to, I think Adele makes a couple of really good points, and one of them is I don't think there's any doubt that Citizens United was one of the most bipartisan, by the way, across ideological lines, most loathed decisions that the court has made in my lifetime. Public opinion on both sides just hated the idea of opening the spigot and allowing dark money to flow into politics, and certainly using the First Amendment and speech rationale to do it. I would also add that I think Janus, the union's case yesterday, is a really good example of what happens when, you know, we are captive to just limitless campaigns to allow dark money to funnel into our politics. But I think the last thing I want to say, I think the most important point that Adele makes, and I think we forget it on both sides of the aisle, is that courts generally are very small C conservative enterprises. And if you look at the long arc of history, whether it's Dred Scott or Korematsu or Citizens United, thinking of courts as the bulwark of progressive values is kind of a folly, because most of the time the court does exist, rightly or wrongly, to do incremental small C conservative things. And I think maybe one of the things we learned in the last week is that to the extent that folks thought the courts were going to save progressive values at this moment in time, it was a bracing reminder that, well, they might not.
We are talking about Justice Anthony Kennedy, both his decision to retire, his legacy on the court, and the coming battle to confirm a replacement. Let's go back in history a little bit, back to 2000. Justice Anthony Kennedy was the swing vote in the Bush v. Gore decision that essentially handed the presidency to George W. Bush. It settled the dispute over the 2000 presidential election. Here he is questioning Gore's attorney about those infamous hanging chads.
You're looking at a piece of paper, and the Supreme Court in the state of South Dakota and in the other case have told us that you will count this if it's hanging by two corners or one corner. This is susceptible of a uniform standard, and yet you say it can vary from table to table within the same county.
There's Justice Anthony Kennedy talking about those hanging chads during the Bush v. Gore or in the lead up to the Bush v. Gore decision. Josh Gerstein, I wanted to ask you and Dahlia about this because I remember that well. I covered that campaign, and I remember being struck by one thing. I would hear from a lot of Democrats and liberals back then saying the Supreme Court is the right place to put this dispute. They're the adults in the room. They're going to make the right decision. And maybe, according to a lot of people, they did make the right decision. But talk about the consequences, I guess, of where Anthony Kennedy came down in that decision.
Well, I mean, they couldn't have been more significant. We're talking about basically selecting who the next president was going to be and installing George W. Bush into that position. But it does get, I think, Anthony, to the broader issue that you're raising about whether in some of these disputes there are sort of limits on what people can expect from the courts. I think Dahlia may have been alluding to this earlier as well. We saw that in Kennedy's sort of unusual two-page concurrence in the travel ban decision earlier this week, where he basically I think to borrow a phrase from Dahlia, he basically threw up his hands and said, this is not something the courts can work out. I think there were actually legitimate reasons for someone to take that position. I don't know if Kennedy explained them terribly well, but it shows sort of, what happens if one thinks that somehow the Supreme Court is ultimately, or Kennedy himself, going to serve as the savior of the country on some of these very, very contentious issues.
Interesting. Dahlia, do you want to add to that?
Excuse me. I think the only thing I would add is that just in addition to what Josh just said about the travel ban, you know, the other issue that the court was going to save us, and I mean all of us, right and left, was meant to be political gerrymanders, right? This was going to be the issue of the term. I have fairly good reporting suggesting that one of the reasons Anthony Kennedy didn't retire last year was to stick around and do something he'd been promising to do for decades, and that is to finally an unconstitutional political gerrymander so we could, from both Democrats and Republican perspectives, do away with, I think, one of the most pernicious and toxic things that are going on in this country to suppress meaningful voting. And as you know, the court kicked away both of the cases that were before the court, one brought by Democrats, one brought by Republicans, and again, flung up its hands and said, we don't know. We know we've been promising, but we just don't have a justiciable standard. And so I think it's of a piece with what Josh is describing, which is it almost feels as though the court this year said, we understand there are these intractable issues, but they're too political for us to touch. So best of luck, other branches of government, because we can't do it. And there's something about Anthony Kennedy making that statement when for decades he has held himself out as the person who would be the grown-up in the room. That's just extra dispiriting in this moment.
Interesting. Some comments here from our listeners. Jeff Schwartz writes on Facebook, this is the real reason for such a big turnout for Trump, having a Supreme Court that actually follows the Constitution and makes rulings based on law and not emotion is a must. And here's Josh Strenz. He commented on our website with this. Let's not overlook the lower level courts, which already have been transformed. The politicizing of the judiciary is an even greater long-term problem for this country than any short-term political decisions. There is no longer the separation of powers, one of the basic foundation stones of our democracy. And let's take some calls. Let's go to Michael, who's calling from Chestertown, Maryland. Michael, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Anthony. I think that these are potentially very dark days for constitutionalism and democracy in the American Republic. The Senate is the only way to deter the appointment of a conservative justice. The Republicans control it. Leader McConnell deliberately stole the seat from President Obama. Gorsuch lied about his so-called neutrality in the hearings. Now we're going to have to defend the Voting Rights Act negatives. They're constantly coming in the Ohio case last week. Weakening of unions, the whole question of abortion rights, the whole question of gerrymandering. The candidates who Trump will put forward are from the hard right Federalist Society. The court at least had somewhat reasonable credibility compared to the Congress or the presidency at this point. When Trump has confirmed a right-wing justice, the actual standing of the court will suffer just as badly as the reputation of Congress and the White House. So these are very dangerous days for constitutional democracy. The only way to stop it is for the Democrats to retake the Senate, and that's a climb. They may retake the House, but it doesn't have a part of it.
All right, Michael, we got your
worrying development.
Yep, Michael, I hear where you're coming from, and I really appreciate the call. And we're going to get into the politics of this and where this is going in a moment. But Dahlia, let me come to you. Michael made reference to the list of potential candidates that Trump may be choosing from. Tell us what we know about that list.
This was the first presidential candidate in history who said, I'm going to show you who I'm going to pick. And he ran. There were three iterations of this list, as Josh suggested. The third iteration we saw on November 17th, 2017. And there are 25 names on it. And as the caller suggests, most of those folks were vetted and selected by the Heritage Foundation, the Federalist Society. This is almost entirely entirely been contracted out to movement conservative groups. And I guess I should add one of the, I think the youngest person on the list is 37, but the president did say he plans to put on someone who is going to serve for 40 years. So I think that I would say the list is overwhelmingly very young. It's quite overwhelmingly white and male. The names I think you're going to want to watch for are Brett Kavanaugh. He's on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. Thomas Hardiman on the Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. Amy Coney Barrett is on a lot of people's short list. She's on the Seventh Circuit. Allison Eade on the Tenth Circuit are just some of the names to watch going forward.
We're talking about Justice Anthony Kennedy's decision to retire, the political battle to come in the effort to confirm a replacement. You can join the conversation. What do you think of all this? Where does the court go from here? We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Whether it's athlete protests, the Muslim travel ban, gun violence, school reform, or just the music that's giving you life right now, race is the subtext to so much of the American story. And on Code Switch, we make that subtext text. You can listen to us on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about Justice Anthony Kennedy's retirement and his role in this year's major Supreme Court cases, as well as the stamp he's left over what has been close to three decades on the court. You can join the conversation. What do you think was the most important Supreme Court case of this term? Which decision surprised you the most? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. After Justice Kennedy announced his retirement yesterday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said the Senate would confirm the next justice within the next few months.
The Senate stands ready to fulfill its constitutional role by offering advice and consent on President Trump's nominee to fill this vacancy. We will vote to confirm Justice Kennedy's successor this fall.
Now, McConnell said something very different back in 2016 after President Obama nominated Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court.
Let's let the American people decide. The Senate will appropriately revisit the matter when it considers the qualifications of the nominee the next president nominates, whoever that might be.
Not surprisingly, yesterday, Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer called for Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to respect his own precedent and wait until after the midterms to confirm Justice Kennedy's replacement.
Millions of people are just months away from determining the senators who should vote to confirm or reject the president's nominee, and their voices deserve to be heard now, as Leader McConnell thought they should deserve to be heard then. Anything but that would be the absolute height of hypocrisy.
I'm talking with Dahlia Lithwick, Slate's courts and law reporter, and Josh Gerstein, senior reporter with Politico covering the White House and the Supreme Court. And Josh, give us your sense on how you see this royal political battle playing out in the next few months.
Well, I think it's a little more complicated than some folks have been suggesting to just say, well, the Republicans are in control of the Senate, therefore whatever Trump does is going to be rubber stamped. They're not that much in control of the Senate. I mean, they have 51 votes in the Senate, so they have a one-vote majority. You have Senator John McCain, who is gravely ill, and his health status we get different reports on from week to week. He hasn't voted in months. And so it hangs by a fairly thin thread. I think it's fair to assume that Mitch McConnell will be able to usher a Trump nominee over the finish line. But I do think that the White House, as they're thinking about who to pick as the nominee, has to realize that things are not exactly the same as they were last year, both because of the current situation in the Senate, but also because of the way in which this nomination will be considered to hold the court in the balance. Now, we had before basically Justice Scalia's seat being filled by another conservative, but now we have a more moderate justice potentially being replaced by a conservative one, which is a very, very significant move. And there will be a lot of pressure on the few moderate Republican senators, I think, to urge the White House to move towards a nominee that will not be as extreme as they might have picked had they their druthers and were just sort of picking names at their own will.
Right. So you're thinking of moderates like Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. Could they shift toward the Democrats and make this next nomination less than certain, in your view, or just the idea that they could put pressure on the White House to choose a more moderate nominee?
Right. I think the latter. And, you know, the key phrase here is more moderate. You know, I don't think you're going to get a moderate. And presumably, as Dahlia said earlier, the White House is confident, for example, in the views on the abortion issue of all 25 names on this list. But I think some of the reason you're seeing names like Brett Kavanaugh come to the fore, and some of the names that you see people being discussing in terms of potentially selecting a woman nominee, I see that as a potential way for the White House to try to scramble this political dynamic a little bit. There was a lot of talk the last time around that the White House may have passed up the chance to select a woman nominee because they saw this fight potentially coming down the road.
All right. Let's go back to our phone calls. John is calling from Amherst, New York. John, you're on the air. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, guys. I hate to be the skunk in the dinner party, but I am a conservative and I am overjoyed by what is occurring right now. You know, I don't know where most of the people who are against a conservative judge are coming from. When they talk about rolling back this, rolling back that, you know, like we're going to use coat hangers again and things like that, and gay people are going to be put back in closets. It's insanity. That is hyperbole, and I don't believe it. I am a person who just is a live and let live individual. I am as conservative as they come. You guys have got to get used to the fact that most people are not that crazy left. You know, they can talk all they want about outrage and how this is going to turn the election. And as far as how people hate Trump, I'll tell you one thing about Trump. Trump is a boor. He is a reckless with his mouth. But I'll tell you, he's my boor, and I'll let him be reckless with his mouth as long as he does conservative things. And putting a justice on the court that'll put a halt to the Supreme Court is something that we conservatives just crave because we know the importance. Just like you guys know the importance of what's going on right now. And I do believe that they should stop this filibuster 60 vote garbage, because that was only incorporated to put through the Bork and Kennedy and all that stuff era.
Okay, well, so the filibuster is stopped. This next nominee will be approved by a simple majority. But, John, what do you mean by stopping the Supreme Court? You use that term. I'm interested to hear more about what you have to say about this.
Stop it. What do you mean by stopping the Supreme
No, you
Court?
Used that term. You said you're hoping that this next nominee can stop the Supreme Court, and I didn't know where you were going with that.
From going so far left and things like that. For things like abortion, let me just say, for instance, okay, maybe someone will bring a case up about abortion that, hey, why should taxpayer money go to do it? It's a vile act, and someone could probably make the case.
Okay, John, we got it. I want to put your point to Dahlia Lithwick. Dahlia, respond to John. I mean, this idea that liberals are sort of up in arms potentially about what could happen to gay rights, to abortion rights on the Supreme Court. Are they wrong to be up in arms? Are they wrong to be concerned?
A couple of responses. One is taxpayer money doesn't fund abortions. The Hyde Amendment has made sure of that for a very long time. So taxpayer money hasn't been directed to abortions in a long time in this country. And I think the idea that we're going back to coat hangers or putting gay couples into the closet is kind of precisely the rhetoric that kind of obscures what is a really nuanced problem. Whether we go back to coat hangers or not seems not to be the issue. We did have a natural experiment in Texas when all but a handful of clinics had to shut down after Texas regulated most of them out of existence in the whole women's health case. We did see massive spikes in the numbers numbers of attempts at self-abortion, women who cross the border to Mexico to have incredibly dangerous, life-threatening abortions. So I'm not entirely sure that it's fair to say, this isn't going to touch women's actual reproductive health. I think it's going to very much affect them. Texas was a natural experiment in what happened when we regulated abortion almost out of existence. On the question of do we have a wild-eyed, radical, lefty Supreme Court that looks like the Warren Court that's finding all these imaginary rights, I think one of the callers said, deciding based on feelings and not the law. I mean, I think that probably more than anything shows how successful the conservative movement has been at messaging the idea that a court on which John Roberts will be the center vote is some kind of hippie liberal Warren Court. I mean, the court has not been that kind of liberal court in decades. More than anything, I think it's fair to say, and there's data to show this, that five of the most conservative jurists who have sat on the Supreme Court in the last 100 years were on the current court when Antonin Scalia died. So the idea that the court is rabid liberal is just, it's a great talking point. It is not supported by any facts.
All right, let's hear a little bit more tape from this current Supreme Court term. During a meeting with congressional leaders at the White House on Tuesday, President Trump called the Supreme Court's ruling on his travel ban and upheld his travel ban a great victory for both the Constitution and the American people.
This is a great victory for our Constitution. We have to be tough and we have to be safe and we have to be secure. At a minimum, we have to make sure that we vet people coming into the country. We know who's coming in. We know where they're coming from. We just have to know who's coming here.
And after that decision, Rasha Mubarak of the Council on American-Islamic Relations had some strong words about the decision.
We are absolutely mortified to see such an atrocious decision made by the highest of the courts. There was so much hostility in the intent of this ban. There is hostility against Islam and marginalizing and criminalizing a group of people based on how they pray.
Two very different views there on the Supreme Court's decision to uphold President Trump's travel ban. Let's go to Mary, who's calling from Southbury, Connecticut. Mary, go ahead. You're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Anthony. Thank you. I would like everybody in your audience to read the book How Democracies Die by Levitsky and Ziblatt. They talk quite a bit about how we think there's a big coup for democracy to, be overthrown, but actually it's death blow by blow, and the courts are part of it. I think President Obama tried to put moderate people on the court. The Republicans tend to put ideologues, so it is laughable about that we try to pack the courts with activists when it's actually what the Republicans do. And I'm going to say one thing to your guest, John, or to your caller, John. He would make a great soundbite for any woman running for office because he would be the poster guy for a clueless, white, heterosexual, privileged male.
Okay, Mary, I'm going to take your first point and go with that. I want to try to keep the sort of ad hominem attacks at a minimum, but I really appreciate your call. Josh, respond to Mary's point about Democrats go with the moderates, Republicans go with the ideologues. Is that a fair distinction, or would you add some nuance to that?
I mean, there's a little bit of nuance there. I think there has been a tendency in recent years, as we've seen groups like the Federalist Society come to the forefront in the conservative and Republican legal movement to see their nominees go in a more ideological direction and more pressure, certainly under the Trump administration, to select pure pedigree conservative nominees. Some of that, frankly, comes from Republican activists who feel they've been burned by prior nominees, including Anthony Kennedy and including Sandra Day O'Connor, among others. So I think people have different perspectives on that. Sonia Sotomayor, who is an Obama appointee, is, I think, in the eyes of many, maybe the most liberal member of the court at this point. But as I said, all these things are relative. And I think the way the frame that we put around this has definitely shifted to the right again and again over time, which makes it hard to say, you know, in some grand scheme of things, where these folks stand on some huge century-long ideological perspective.
All right. Well, Mary, thanks for that call. Let's go to Rick, who's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Rick, you're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. This is definitely a question of hypotheticals, but with the Mueller investigation possibly being wrapped up about the same time as the vote for the Supreme Court, is there any legal precedent as to whether if a president is under indictment or whatever, if he has the right to still nominate someone to the highest court in the land? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, Rick, thanks for that question. Dahlia, I don't know if you want to take that on. I mean, will the new justice have any impact, or will this debate, this moment of thinking about a new justice in the Supreme Court, have any impact on the Mueller investigation?
Well, I thought Rick's question was interesting because I think what he's asking is, can we weaponize the McConnell rule that said, oh, you know, if a president only has a few months left in office, maybe he shouldn't get to seat someone. And I think what Rick is asking is, can you weaponize that to say, oh, if a president is under indictment, can he not seat someone? And I think it's certainly an idea I've heard Senate Democrats fussing with, but I don't think there's any precedent or reason to believe that will preclude Mitch McConnell for going forward. On your question of whether, you know, this will intersect at some point, that this fifth conservative justice will intersect with questions around the Mueller probe, that really is interesting and unknown. I mean, there are so many ways that the fruit of the Mueller probe could end up in some way or another in front of the Supreme Court, also sorts of unresolved constitutional questions about whether presidents can pardon themselves, about whether you can indict a sitting president, things that may or may not play out in the fall after Mueller offers up his report to Congress, whether Congress moves to impeach. These kinds of issues could presumably at some point surface at the Supreme Court. And so it's not at all fanciful to suggest that whoever the person is that is tapped going forward might sit on a case that has to do with executive power and pardon and impeachment and indictment someday very soon. It's mind-blowing, but I don't think it's out of the realm of possibilities now.
Boy, mind-blowing indeed. Josh Gerstein, we only have about 10 or 15 seconds left. Final thought for you. I mean, you know, such a politically charged and divisive moment in our country's history, and along comes this big issue of naming a new Supreme Court justice. It is quite a sort of political mix that we have here.
It is, with all the questions that Dahlia was talking about the president, the ongoing investigation, and we expect those to be at the forefront of the coming election, which I think everyone is expecting to be unusually tense and contested. And now you have this injected into that mix. It's going to be, I think, a real test, particularly on the side of Democrats, as to whether they can motivate the base around an issue of the courts that they have traditionally struggled mightily to get folks to actually cast votes on. We'll see if that happens this year or not.
And we'll know soon enough. Josh Gerstein, senior White House reporter at Politico, where he also covers the Supreme Court. Josh, thank you so much for today. We really appreciated having you.
Happy to be here.
And same to you, Dahlia Lithwick, courts and law reporter for Slate and host of the Amicus podcast. Dahlia, thank you. Have a great day.
Thanks, Anthony.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, on the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. That's it for this hour. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.